Okay, ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you back to the narrative stage for the last presentation of the day. And I'd like to welcome you to Folk Life if you just come here. It's been kind of cold, but at least it's not raining. But anyway, I'm very privileged to be able to present, to be able to introduce Mr. Alvin Singh, who is a great nephew of one of the great iconic musicians of American musical history, Huey Leadbetter, a.k.a. Leadbelly. And Mr. Singh is a curator of a Leadbelly archive, I believe, and is going to give you a whole presentation about the work and the research that he's doing. So take it away.
Appreciate it. First of all, I'd like to say thank you for Folk Life and everybody here that's attending, and just to hear some of the stories that I'm going to talk about. Some of you, and you can pass the book around. That's the book that we're selling. It's all the donations going to the Leadbelly Foundation. And it's a coffee table book that we just completed last year. No, 2008. Of all these pictures and archive material that's been locked away in my grandmother's trunk for over 60 years. And we finally went through it. And because, you know, she was very, you know, protective of a lot of these things. You're going to see some of the pictures. And she re-released it with a German publisher called Steidl. And that's it. So you can pass around. We have some copies if you want. And if you have any questions or anything, just feel free to ask them or chime in and just tell any other stories that you know about Leadbelly. This is the Leadbelly organization's website, leadbelly.org, for the foundation. And like I said, this story, it originally starts with my grandmother. Her name is Tiny Robinson, and she's from Shreveport, Louisiana. And at the age of 17, she moved to New York City to live with my grandma, her aunt, whose name is Martha. And Martha was Leadbelly's wife. And at the age of 17, during that time, it's sort of like, you know, what are you going to do next? You know, if you're not going to work, you know, being from the South, she was not going to, you know, work in the South with a farm. And, you know, New York City was an attractive place for a lot of African Americans to find jobs and different lifestyle. So she moved up to New York, and that's where she stayed for the next at least 40, 55 years until she moved to Nashville, Tennessee, where I'm originally from. Here she is right here with Gordon Parks. When Gordon Parks did the 1976 biography movie on Leadbelly. And it's interesting to know that Gordon Parks has five movies that he's released. One of them is popularly known as The Shaft. And this is the only movie that was never released on VHS tape or DVD by Gordon Parks. It was done in 30 days, and it's a brief period of Leadbelly's life. So here she is. She actually was an extra on the set. They were filming in Texas at the time. And when I was growing up, one of the things, this is what I would see on the wall at my grandmother's house. And if you notice, it's not a college diploma. And it's not a certificate. It's a prison pardon. And this prison pardon is from the state of Texas. And so I said, you know, well, grandmother, what is this? And whose is it? And, you know, who does it belong to? And she said, well, that's our uncle, Leadbelly. He was a famous blues musician who was pardoned twice, once from the state of Texas and once from the state of Louisiana. And that's kind of what I've always known. I see pictures of him. She'll go on a trip when I was in middle school and sort of high school. She'll go on trips to accept awards for him. She went in 1988 to accept the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame Inductee Award. And so I saw this, you know, prison pardon, and it represented something differently in our house as opposed to something negative. Here's another photo of Leadbelly. Actually, this is Tiny Robinson on the right, my grandmother on the right in a white shirt, and that's Martha in the middle. And the little boy sitting on Leadbelly's lap is actually my father. And these are about the last few months of Leadbelly's life. And in the book, we have a lot of these photos that are rare photos that are, you know, a lot of Library of Congress didn't have and a Smithsonian Museum didn't have. So she mentioned Leadbelly to me as someone who was part of a larger group of other famous musicians. And some of these people that were just Leadbelly's friends who would just come by the apartment and just come by and play and just talk to him were people like Pete Seeger, Paul Robeson, Woody Guthrie, Alan Lomax, Richard Wright, the famous writer of Native Son, Langston Hughes, Zora Neale Hurston, Harry Belafonte, Brownie McGee, Sonny Terry, Cisco Houston. All of these different musicians would come by Leadbelly's house and you know, get the rehearsal on, because he was the oldest person out of everybody. And Leadbelly lived a life that many of them had never seen or lived themselves. So his house was sort of like the incubator for everything and the rehearsal area. He's also known as the king of the 12-string guitar. And right here is Leadbelly's guitar called Stella. That's what he called it. And the guitar right now is at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland, Ohio. Here's Leadbelly on downtown Shreveport, where he's pointing. It's a statue where he's pointing in the direction of what was at the time Fannin Street. And Fannin Street is one of Leadbelly's most popular songs. And it's about Fannin Street at the time was sort of like a red light district. It was a place where when Leadbelly was a little boy, his father would come from the farm area and basically cover Leadbelly up from seeing the bars and the ladies dancing in the window and things like that. And it's funny that when Leadbelly became old enough, Fannin Street was the first place that he went as soon as he became old enough, and, you know, to play his music and just to see it. And now you can see him point in a direction where it's now called Leadbetter Heights. So you can, it's safe enough to say that Leadbelly turned that section of town into his own town. Even, you know, 60 years later is named after him. So this is the statue still there today. And I guess one of the things to kind of put into perspective Leadbelly's history, he grew up in Mooringsport, Louisiana, which is northern Louisiana. And his family moved there at the time where it was a great oil rush. And they were looking for jobs, and everyone was kind of going to this part of Louisiana to hopefully receive work from the oil fields. And Leadbelly's family grew up on a farm. It was 60 acres, and his father was very proud of that. It was a very independent ownership of them. And so Leadbelly grew up sort of a spoiled child. And when Leadbelly became old enough, he played in a church. He played the piano in the church, and he picked up music very early from his uncle. And when, like I said earlier, when he became old enough, he went to the local music scene to go and practice some of his music. And that's where he would get into back then, where if he was to perform, he was the center of attention. And so, you know, just like today, that causes jealousy. You know, girls is dancing and they're, you know, screaming for Leadbelly, go ahead and sing some more, sing to us. And, you know, he's going to be the entertainer. He's going to sing for them. And at the same time, you have, you know, husbands and boyfriends, you know, sharpening their knives and just getting jealous or, you know, whatever reason. And they'll take it out on Leadbelly. And he often would have to defend himself at that point. And this got Leadbelly into trouble early. And one of the places that he ended up at was in Texas. And it was called Sugarland Prison Farm. And here, this is where Leadbelly was part of a chain gang. And he picked up a lot of the work songs in his repertoire of songs where it was folk songs where when you sung it together, the lead singer would catch the rhythm. And there's some video that I've actually seen of Pete Seeger where he's performing. He's talking about Leadbelly and what Leadbelly was doing. And, you know, Leadbelly had these work songs. And Pete Seeger, I used to perform with a log on stage. and an axe. And what he would do is, he every time he hit it, that represented the beat. And, you know, Lead Belly was the lead singer for those Chain Gangs. And he was just popularly known in the prison as the man to go to. And so in Texas prison, the governor, Pat Neff, was doing a tour. And he comes by the prison and he says, you know, I want some entertainment. And, of course, the prison guards and the prisoners say, well, Lead Belly is the best guitar player. You know, he's the person that can, you know, entertain you. And while Lead Belly's performing, he used that opportunity to write an impromptu song right there on the spot, asking Governor Pat Neff, you know, if I had you like you had me, I'll wake up in the morning and I'll set you free. And again, Pat Neff ran his entire governor campaign that he would never free anybody. And sure enough, the day of his last day in governor, he pardoned Lead Belly. And that was the pardon that we saw earlier. And he pardoned Lead Belly, and Lead Belly got out. And he moved right back to, in that time period, he met Blind Lemon Jefferson. And him and Blind Lemon Jefferson were really good friends. And they would go to Dallas and all throughout Southeast Texas to perform at these places. They'd get on trains and they'd go to the next town and they'd perform there and get on another train and perform there. And whatever money they made, they split it together. And it was a really good friendship. And only years later, when Lead Belly was in jail again in Angola, with Blind Lemon Jefferson become the first blues musician to be recorded. I think it was in record label in Memphis that actually recorded his music. But when Lead Belly got out in Texas, he moved back to Louisiana, and he went by the name of Walter Boyd, as sort of a alias name, and he would still perform for the local places, and you know, he would still work at farm jobs as a sharecropper or something like that a lot of times. And again, he would take his guitar, and wherever he performed, people would gather around. People gather around, women's going to dance, fights are going to break out. Any questions? This was, so he went in 19, he got released in 35, so this had to be 1928, 1930. And this incident, Lead Belly, it's been tons of stories on this one. One is Lead Belly was at a bar, and of course, being segregated, the South, the white patrons didn't want him in there, and they wanted the Lead Belly to leave. And of course, Lead Belly, being as stubborn or, you know, as confident as he is, he didn't back down. He says, I'm drinking, I'm not bothering anybody. And the fight broke out, and somehow the guy that Lead Belly got in a fight with gets cut with a knife on his arm. And Lead Belly ends up in Angola. He goes to jail, and there's a white mob ready to lynch Lead Belly. And they call in the sheriffs to release him and, you know, take him out. We ready to get him and everything. And somehow Lead Belly escapes that, and then he gets sent to Angola State Farm Prison, which is the oldest prison in the United States today. Louisiana, yeah. And during that time, and then another story is that, so many of them. We know that it was a confrontation, and Lead Belly ended up in prison. And this time it was assault with intent to murder. So he got 25 to 30 years in prison, and Angola Prison Farm, which... a friend of mine, Daniel, who's doing research there today, says it's still the same way. It's two plantations that were merged together after the Civil War, and it's over like 10,000 acres of farm, and it's a prison industrial complex. And while Lead Belly was at the farm at the Angola prison, Alan Lomax and John Lomax were going around recording folk songs, and specifically black folk songs, for a second addition to something that John Lomax was doing earlier, which was cowboy folk songs. And the Library of Congress at the time gave him a grant to go around and collect more songs, but they felt that the best way to do it is to go to the prisons, because at this time that, you know, modern music was coming into the play, jazz music was coming out, and a lot of African Americans were and people in general were just kind of wanting to hear the new stuff and not practicing it and, you know, not recording it. And they felt that prison was the place, because some of these guys were there 30, 25 years and they hadn't heard these commercial songs. And so Lead Belly was one of the people that John Lomax recorded. Here's, you can see some of the pictures, rare pictures of Lead Belly with the, you know, performing at house parties. Okay, so Lead Belly and John Lomax met each other in 1933. That's Alan Lomax right there. So in 1933, John Lomax and his son Alan Lomax enter Angola prison with a recording device, and they record Lead Belly, and that's the first recording of Goodnight Irene. There were some other songs that Lead Belly performed that ended up being some children's songs, and Take This Hammer, Grey Goose. I'm going to play some of those later. And when they came back the next year, in 1934, Lead Belly again was prepared. And this time he had a song for Governor O.K. Allen, who was the governor of Louisiana at the time. And he says, well, if you can, take this song to the governor and maybe he'll set me free. You know, I've done it before and I hope maybe it'll be done again. And, you know, John Lomax was basically saying, you know, I can't promise you that, Lead Belly. I don't really know the governor like that, but if you give it to me, maybe I can. And what we do know is that Alan Lomax said that they did drop the recording at the secretary's office, but they're not sure that the governor listened to it. But what we do know is that in 1935, Lead Belly was released. 1 year later, he was released for good behavior. Lead Belly would like to say, you know, he sung his way out of prison twice. Myth, you know, is that he sung his way out of prison twice. There's another fact to say, well, that was during the time of Great Depression, so prisoners who were on doing good behavior, they were releasing them earlier because of food and just taking care of them. But the good thing to take from that story is that Lead Belly met Lomax, and that Lomax not necessarily discovered Lead Belly. And a lot of encyclopedias and a lot of history books, it kind of quotes Lomax discovered Lead Belly at this prison. Now, this is a time where Lead Belly is about 40-something years old. He's a grown man, and he's lived many years of his life incarcerated, and he doesn't want, and both times were times of self-defense, not malicious crimes where he went and robbed or, you know, he intentionally killed someone or anything like that. This was, you know, the Jim Crow South where if you, you know, even whistled at the wrong person, you would get, you know, entrapped. And so Lead Belly took this opportunity to then continue doing music. And the first person he contacted was John Lomax, and he asked John Lomax, because he's thinking that John Lomax was the reason that he got pardon. So he said, you know, Lomax, if you need any help, I'm willing to help you. And so Lomax was on a second wing of his tour to the prison camps, and he said, well, Lead Belly, I need someone that can translate what I want to do for these prisoners, because, you know, here he is as a white male coming in with these big recording devices asking black folk singers to sing songs. And it's not that easy, you know, for them to build that trust up. And so Lead Belly naturally had the guitar with him. He'll start playing, and then that's when they'll open up and start giving him some of the songs. During this time, this is where Lead Belly learned Rock Island Line in Arkansas. 35. And this in 1935, Lead Belly was very busy because he also got married. This is a wedding picture of him and Martha. And you see John Lomax. And right, Alan Lomax behind Lead Belly, and Martha with the white gloves. Here's another picture of him and Martha right here. And she's from Shreveport, and her and Lead Belly knew each other before he moved up north. And when he moved up north, after working with John Lomax to go to a lot of the universities. So what Leadbelly and Lomax would do where there was this combination of presentation and performances where Lomax would set up lectures at Harvard and Yale and Princeton and all of these different academic circles. And he would talk about these unrecorded songs that's in the South. And then he'll have Leadbelly come out on stage and perform. And some of these early performances, he encouraged or kind of talked Leadbelly into wearing prison stripes. And like I said earlier, Leadbelly's a freedman, and he's 40-something years old. You know, no one is going to want to do that. You know, even today, you know, you take guys who've been locked up, they're not going to put on the orange uniform at all anymore. When you're free and the paper says you're free, you're not going to play that role anymore. And so him and Leadbelly had a disagreement at this time. The management was not fair to Leadbelly. He started learning about the business of music. And actually, he's in New York City, so he doesn't have to worry about going to these juke joints and you know, people tossing coins. He's getting real popular around the folk scene, and people are actually asking him to perform at some of the fundraisers for, like, what would be called left-wing kind of parties. And so during this time, these were some of the promotional pitches that they wanted Leadbelly kind of play the country musician farmer with the handkerchief and, you know, overalls and things like that. And in reality, Leadbelly wanted to wear his suit and tie. Here's a program that they would do of Leadbelly as he had come into a city and perform or come to a university and perform. And during this time while he was in New York, my grandmother told me that, like I said earlier, a lot of these people would come by the house and just perform impromptu. And Woody Guthrie was one of those people. And Leadbelly and Woody Guthrie were really close friends. She told me that there was time that, you know, Woody Guthrie would stay at the apartment and her and Aunt Martha would try to kick him out because it was getting past, you know, late. And, you know, Leadbelly said, oh, no, let him stay. You know, this, you know, he's all right. Let him stay. Because Woody kind of lived the unconventional life at that time. And she also told me that Woody always wrote his music down and was writing. He'd have pieces of paper and sketching artwork and just doodling and different things like that. And something that Leadbelly did not do. See, Leadbelly would learn songs from off the top of his head. And he'll remake them into his own versions where Woody would sort of listen to what's going on in the news and then he'll write about it. And you know, that was kind of Woody's style. And so the Guthries in my family, we have a really good relationship with each other. Really good. Yeah, we're really close. And Nora Guthrie is over the Guthrie Foundation. She's very approachable. I think she's come here a couple of times, a couple of years ago. And I kind of talked to her about a lot of things during that time and, you know, how she's doing things. And they're very helpful. Arlo Guthrie, who is someone that I got a chance to meet during the documentary while we were filming. And Arlo, I mean, it took him about 5 minutes of reflecting. He was just quiet. And he was talking about Leadbelly was his first memory as a three-year-old. And he said, what kind of impact can someone make on a three-year-old that they're going to remember them? And you know, Arlo is such a comedian. You know, he has all of these jokes about him and Woody. He would say, people would come up to him and Woody Guthrie and say, well, you know, what side are you on? You on the left wing or the right wing? What side are you on? And Woody would say, left wing, right wing, chicken wing, they're all the same, you know. And so these are kind of the stories that Arlo was sharing with me that we're going to release in a documentary, too, as well. There's Woody Guthrie right there. Here's a picture that's a lot of, it's not actually in the book. This is a picture of Leadbelly and Woody Guthrie performing together. And this picture, it speaks a lot to me. One, Woody is looking at Leadbelly kind of laughing. Two, you see Leadbelly with all white hair. He's obviously... he's 60 years old probably at this picture. And then three, you see the ladies on the couch looking at Woody and Lead Belly, you know, as if, you know, they're just listening to this performance. And then also what I noticed in this picture, if you look at Lead Belly's guitar, look how big it is. I mean, it's almost like it's just like a perfect eight-figure shape, you know, hourglass shape in that picture. And it just stands out because that 12-string was such a loud sound, and Lead Belly liked that loud sound. And when he was younger, one of the stories is that he learned the 12-string from a Mexican band while he was in Texas. And he heard them performing it, and that's when he picked it up. And he changed from 16-string to the 12-string. And, of course, Lead Belly being the promoter that he is, he immediately called himself the king of the 12-string as soon as he picked it up. And this picture right here is something that we've been trying to defend and sort of take down as this negative image of Lead Belly as a monster, this, you know, ex-convict, sings the blues kind of image of him. You know, yes, he did go to prison and he did time in jail, but he was not, as a performer that we know Lead Belly, he never wore these stripes. So it's almost saying that the time period that we know him as a musician, he didn't look like this. So a lot of artists, a lot of painters who are actually, you know, Lead Belly fans and record labels have CD covers with him with, you know, made up with, you know, prison tags and things like that. And it's marketable to sell Lead Belly there as opposed to some of the stories that he really sung. Right here is a cartoon sketch of Lead Belly. And it talks, you know, of course, the first scene is, you know, he finds Lead Belly and he's in the prison. And the second scene, you know, they're going to the universities to talk. And Lead Belly's his chauffeur. And Lead Belly makes the news. And this is all in that 1 year period that him and Lead Belly knew each other. And Lead Belly was on the March of Time, which was a news series before television. What people would do is they would go to the movie theaters to catch news. And the March of Time it's a real big archive of all of these short segments of news where they come and talk about what's going on with the war and things like that. So Lead Belly, they did a book. Lomax wrote a book of Lead Belly's lyrics. He got married. You know, he was doing a, you know, nationwide tour on college universities. He recorded for the March of Times. He recorded for the Library of Congress. All of these different things in such a short period of time. And then at the end, it shows Lead Belly with his suit on, but it has the ball and chain on it. And these are sort of the things that my grandmother just would always make sure she defended it to say that that wasn't the real Lead Belly character. Tower Records. This was a Tower Records. It says, yeah, Pulse, 1943? It can't be that early. I can be able to tell you later when we look at it. Or it may be in a book, actually. But it is a famous painter. Yeah. It is a famous graphic illustrator. He's very popular. And that's kind of what we were like, you know, like, here's someone that done something, but he didn't get it correctly. And here's a Life magazine where it says, you know, bad end does good minstrel. And this was Lead Belly when he was alive, actually. It was an unusual article on a black entertainer. It was highlighting him, but it just the headline is not what we would consider PR today. You know, you would never do that. Time or Life magazine would never write that right now. Here's a picture of Lead Belly when he would perform, because these were the sort of the images that my grandmother wanted to make sure that people saw and always she spoke about. Also, one thing that's interesting is that Lead Belly did an album of children's songs. And today is one of his most popular songs. Smithsonian Folkways released it. And I've actually seen it in baby toy stores. They have little sessions where they have little, you know, lullabies and, you know, Baby Einstein, Beatles, and all these. And they have Lead Belly sings to children. And, you know, that goes to show a lot about himself as a performer and where he was able to cross barriers. You know, he was not afraid to perform for mixed audiences. He was not afraid to perform at prisons. He was not afraid to perform at universities, you know, where, you know, some people will feel kind of, you know, intimidated by this academia. And, you know, he's singing folk songs and he's never been to college, but he always carried himself the same no matter where he went. And here, this is a performance at a children's school right here. And if you look at this picture, you just see the children just glaze their eyes on him. Right. And one of the guys that we interviewed, I went through the archives, and there was a guy who wrote my grandmother to say, you know, I remember Lead Belly when I was in an elementary school. And, you know, he was just making contact with her. And so I researched and found the guy. He lives in New York, actually two blocks away from Oscar Brand. And he had, I mean, it was almost like yesterday. He said that they lined the children up. He remembers they was in school in New York, and they lined the kids up. They took them to the cafeteria, and Lead Belly comes out with the guitar and his loud music, and the kids were just dancing, and he was singing Ha Ha This Way, Skip to the Loo, and Grey Goose. And because a lot of the folk songs had a lot of these fable stories in them, and Lead Belly knew how to tell those stories. Here he is, where he went. He eventually went to California to try to do some cowboy movies, and it's kind of funny because, you know, him and Gene Autry were real good friends, and Gene Autry gave Lead Belly his hat, and Lead Belly gave him a few tunes or you know, a few lessons in the guitar, and Lead Belly, I think, kind of took that friendship and actually went to Hollywood himself to try to get into movies. Now he's like 50 something years old, and you know, black cowboys was not something that people were going to even see at that time. But while he was in Los Angeles at the time, he did a lot of performances at Berkeley. He did performances at UCLA, San Diego. He did performances for the U.S. Navy out there. They was always requesting him to do songs everywhere he went. And this is where that we have the three videos of Lead Belly performing were recorded there. And Pete Seeger, about 15 years later, took 2 weeks of time to edit them together. I'm going to play one of them, part of it, in a few. And so what I've been doing with a lot of this material, like I said, is to gather in, go and talk to all of Lead Belly's friends. That was the first thing I did. I got a grant to do the documentary. There was no full-length documentary on Lead Belly yet. I mean, anytime that I look at the American Master series on Zora Neale Hurston, Woody Guthrie, Pete Seeger just had one, Joan Baez, Paul Robeson, all of them had theirs, and there's always a segment of Lead Belly in it. Or it's just Lomax, and then it talks about Lead Belly, Lomax recording Lead Belly. And so this is when we came in to the idea to do our own documentary. And one of the people that I interviewed was Harry Belafonte. And what he told me was Lead Belly helped him get his presentation together and was how he started his performances with Lead Belly's folk songs. They immediately get the crowd open. And, you know, excited, and he'd get everybody worked up because Lead Belly had a momentum about him. And then that's when he would go into the Caribbean music and sort of Israeli music and all kind of world music from there, Harry Belafonte would do. And he just talked about meeting Lead Belly and what an impact that he made on him as a young musician and a performer and even in acting. And here I'm going to play something about Rock Island Line. Rock Island Line is a song that I told you that Lead Belly learned at in Arkansas. And he learned a song from another prisoner, but the song became popular when Lonnie Donegan performed. Now I'm going to play Leadbelly's version right now.
Now this is Rock Out of Love. I go out on the people's doors and train whistle to talk to the depot agent. Depot agent throw that switchboard over the line, and ain't never gonna talk to him. I got goats, I got sheep, I got cows, I got hogs, I got horses, I got all livestock, I got all livestock. Now that old Rock Island line is getting on down the road. Oh, the Rock Island line, it's a mighty good road. Oh, the Rock Island line, it's a road to ride. Oh, the Rock Island line, it's a mighty good road. If you want to ride, you got to ride it like you're bound to get your ticket and standing on the Rock Island line.
This is one of the rare pictures, too, we have.
Jesus died to save our sins. Glory to God, we're going to meet him again. Oh, the Rock Island line, it's a mighty good road. Oh, the Rock Island line, it's a road to ride. Oh, the Rock Island line, it's a mighty good road. If you want us to ride, you got to ride it like you're bound to get your ticket at the station on the Rock Island line.
So that was Leadbelly's version. And as I've been doing the research, I've been putting a lot of the pieces together. And this, in 1950, a British musician named Lonnie Donegan came out with his version. And Lonnie Donegan ended up being the godfather of skiffle music. And, you know, what group used to open up for Lonnie Donegan? The Beatles. And here's Lonnie Donegan's version right here.
Now this here's a story about the Rock Island Line. The Rock Island Line, she runs down into New Orleans. And just outside of New Orleans, there's a big toll gate. And all the trains, they go through the toll gate while they gotta pay the man some money. But of course, if you got certain things on board, you're okay, you don't have to pay the man nothing. And just now, we see a train, she's coming down the line. And when she come up near the toll gate, the driver, he shout down to the man. He say, I got pigs, I got horses, I got cows. I got sheep, I got all livestock, I got all livestock, I got all livestock. And the man say, well, you're all right, boy, just get on through, you don't have to pay me nothing.
Okay. And of course it didn't end there. I ended up finding one of my favorite musicians. This is his version.
Thank you. Some folks have said that the Rock Island Line runs to New Orleans. Well, I want to tell you that the railroad said it runs to Houston. You know that? So I say the Rock Island Line run down to Houston because the railroad said it does. And they own the trains, you know. I was a little bitty boy, I remember, down at Kingsland, Arkansas. I used to watch my daddy coming back in from kind of hoboing across the country looking for work. You know, he'd borrow himself a ride on a freight train. He'd jump off of that freight train just before it pulled into Kingsland Station because the railroad detectives would get him down there, you know. Come home a little bloody and cut up sometimes. Then that Rock Island train, that Lone Star, would head on up to Shreveport, Memphis, St. Louis, Rock Island, Chicago. Woo-hoo! Down the Rock Island Line, a mighty good road. The Rock Island Line, a road to ride. Rock Island Line, a mighty good road.
All right. God, I got more. I got so much more. And I just found this one recently, too. So you can see the impact that Leadbelly's music eventually had on the whole folk revival and the whole British rock invasion and even you will see now into the grunge music and hip-hop.
Was that last one on White Album?
I'm not sure. That was on YouTube. I need to get the album because I didn't know. I knew that they were fans and they've had, but see, a lot of the Beatles stuff was just kind of like recordings and there weren't necessarily a lot of Lead Belly actual recorded songs that they released. And this is a quote from George Harrison himself, "No Lead Belly, no Beatles." My grandmother said that 3 months before George Harrison passed away, he wanted to do a concert, and he asked her if he can play Lead Belly's guitar. And then not soon later, he passed away. No, he didn't. He didn't get a chance to. He actually. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, Van Morrison is a very big fan. We tried to get him. He actually told us if we get to London, we can interview him. But him and Robert Plant from Led Zeppelin, Jack White, White Stripes, I mean, the list can go on and on. A few more come to my mind as we talk. So when during these New York years, Lead Belly was on a radio station, and he would always record for the Smithsonian Folkways, and he eventually went to Paris, and while he was in France, he was the first blues musician to actually go to Europe. And when he was there, that's when he started feeling pains in his legs and in his arms and everything, and he couldn't necessarily move the muscles that he wanted to, and that's when he was diagnosed with Lou Gehrig's disease, which is a muscle nervous deficiency. And it's sort of ironic that, you know, Lou Gehrig, Iron Man of baseball, had the disease, and Lead Belly, who's the tough man of, you know, blues and folk musician, had the same disease. And this, during this time, my grandmother said that it was really difficult for Lead Belly to play the guitar, and that the children would come up to him and say, "Hey, you know, Uncle Hootie, play music. And, you know, they didn't necessarily know that at this point it was really hard for him to get his fingers to move the way he wanted to. And it really hurt him, she said. And he'll do his last performances sitting down in a chair or with a cane and things like that. And so when he passed away, December 1949, it made a lot of the news media, New York Times, Amsterdam News. People from all over were sending Western Union telegrams to Aunt Martha, just, you know, as condolences. And that's actually where everything else begins after Lead Belly. When Lead Belly passed away, 1 month later, Tom Waits was born. And according to him and Lead Belly changed souls. And he's actually wrote the introduction for the video. I mean, for the book. And Tom Waits is a big fan. And the tape right here that we see, this was owned by Kurt Cobain from Nirvana, from out of his collection. And this is Robert Plant from Led Zeppelin at Lead Belly's old gravesite way in Louisiana. And I've got in the book, I think we saw Allen Ginsberg actually visit Lead Belly, because him and Lead Belly were real good friends. That, you know, him and Lead Belly were real good friends. And you can kind of see the whole chain reaction from the Jack Kerouac book On the Road to the Beatles and Lead Belly, where all of this kind of comes together now. Because I didn't think of poets being influenced by Lead Belly, but when you think of folk is everything. Of course, after Lead Belly passed away, Goodnight Irene became a good hit, big hit, sold 1 million records by the Weavers. Frank Sinatra does it. It sells more. There's a lot of record labels that still release a lot of his music today. A lot of them in the UK re-releases his songs and his music in different versions and just different titles. This is a statue that I actually saw in Nashville Airport. Of a sculptor who did Lead Belly, Woody Guthrie, and I think Paul Robeson and Billie Holiday, I want to say. And this is Lead Belly's gravesite today. So with my grandmother's foundation, she started off as a memorial fund. All of his fans would send money to get Lead Belly a new gravesite. So if we saw, this was his original one. And we just felt that it was time for him to have a proper, you know, memorial. And so that's where she started the funds, and now we have this one. And this is funny because Arlo Guthrie said that when he was in town, he asked the tour driver, bus driver, to take him to Lead Belly's gravesite, and that him and his friend arrived, and they said look at here, you know, they got Lead Belly still locked away, man. Let's free him. And we didn't think about that. You know, you think it because you just want to keep it neat, but Arlo Guthrie has a picture where he's sitting right next to this with the guitar and inside of the memorial. One of the things that I wanted to also show you in the mix of what we was talking about, the influence of his music, was another good song by Lead Belly called Where Did You Sleep Last Night? Oh, I don't have Lead Belly's version. Okay. Here's one of the videos by Lead Belly called Piccabella Cotton. And with this was one of the videos that Pete Seeger had put together, one of the rare videos. And I did this because I'm part of a digital media program here at the University of Washington. And one of the things we're doing is studying how analog to things are going digitally and what kind of impact from, you know, newspapers being shut down to now people reading articles online on their mobile phones and things like that. And so what's interesting to me is that I still like to read books. I still collect records. I still, you know, I have my turntable. But Lead Belly music reaches so many different genres and different formats that this is a short video that I put together of Lead Belly versus Ludacris, who's a hip-hop artist, and you'll see the reason why.
And this is another Wake song. When we pick cotton, you got to jump down to pick a bale of cotton a day. You can't fool around. And we sing. Red God Almighty, I can pick a bale of cotton. Red God Almighty, I can pick a bale a day. Red God Almighty, I can pick a bale of cotton. Red God Almighty, I can pick a bale a day. Oh Lord, I can pick a bale of cotton. Oh Lord, I can pick a bale a day.
Jump down, turn around, pick a bale of cotton. Jump down, turn around, pick a bale of hay. Oh Lordy, pick a bale of cotton. Oh Lordy, pick a bale of hay. Jump down, turn around, pick a bale of cotton. Jump down, turn around, pick a bale of hay. Oh Lordy, pick a bale of cotton. Oh Lordy,
pick a bale of cotton. Oh Lord, I'm 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 pick a bale of cotton.
Right. Right. And that's sort of the kind of paradox with a lot of the music now is you have a lot of people who sing his songs and, you know, or redo his songs, and they may not have lived the life that he lived. But, you know, I guess to me what's most important is that they give the credit where credit is due, and that we have to understand that, you know, It's always going to evolve. You know, Lead Belly didn't want his music to just stay where it is. He wanted it to be passed on. Another good example right here is Where Did You Sleep Last Night? So the song has been called In the Pines or My Girl or Black Girl or Where Did You Sleep Last Night? And I don't know who this one is. Let's just find out. Okay. So this is a prime example. This kid right here, you'll see.
My girl, my girl, don't lie to me. Tell me, where did you sleep?
Now, you think this kid doesn't know anything about relationships and you know, my girl. But to him, and off of the comments, actually, that video had 22,000 views on YouTube, where lead bellies may have 5,000, 6,000, 2,000. And so, and the important things was people are commenting on the video, oh, that's a great Nirvana cover. Oh, no, that's not Nirvana, that's Lead Belly. No, that's not Lead Belly, that's an Appalachian folk song that Lead Belly heard in the 1800s. And so that's the kind of dialogue that it starts from, just a kid who's just doing it, you know, on his web camera. Another example is people just... And also properly, who also popularized the song.
Fuck you all, this is the last song of the evening. This was written by my favorite performer. Our favorite performer, isn't it?
He's talking about this is their favorite performer. This is MTV Unplugged.
Oh, yeah. This guy representing the Lead Belly Estate wants to sell me Lead Belly's guitar for $500,000.
He's saying that someone from the Lead Belly Estate offered to sell Lead Belly's guitar to him for $500,000. Now, I know my grandmother was not going to sell Lead Belly's guitar to Kurt Cobain at that time. You know, to her, she's thinking he's going to do some smashing the guitar, Jimi Hendrix type stuff. So, but... is his version right here. They end up becoming more popular to a different generation. See, I had the Dolly Parton version too. Dolly Parton singing "In the Pines" because there's a lot of country music sing it. And oh, they got them, the Four Pennies. I had two more actually. I wanted to show y'all, but I didn't. Yeah, it's tons of them. A lot of people. That was the point of just amateurs just doing it. And the little kid had more hits than everybody else with 22,000. And there's tons of songs like that. There's Gallus Pole. There's Goodnight Irene. Actually, in the UK, there's a football team. That's their opening theme song. And we found, like, the whole entire stadium sings Goodnight Irene as sort of a chant song. And so, you know, during all of this, I guess the research and learning about this has just been exciting to me. And it's been a blessing as well to just hear the stories from different people who are fans of Lead Belly, hearing different stories from my grandmother about him. And, you know, people like Oscar Brand, who, you know, he's in the Guinness Book of World Record for the oldest radio station, longest radio station. And he told us that he took the radio station from Lead Belly. And Lead Belly was doing it for about 2-3 months, and then he passed away, and then he took on it, and now he still does it, you know, every Saturday from his basement. And it's something that, you know, it's a connection to him, you know, Lead Belly in that. And that's really it. Any more questions or anything? Yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh.
And, you know, how they have to do all the digging.
Right.
You know, find his family and everything. I mean, it's just really cool.
Yeah, I'm trying to actually get the guitar at the EMP if I can, because it's been, you know, in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame for almost 20 years now. And so, yeah. Yeah. All right. Yeah, if anybody wants to get in contact or talk, please. That's fine. Yeah, thank you.